Audio from book, Secrets of the UFO, by Don Elkins with Carla Rukert. From 1976. Some of the numbers mentioned, may be footnotes. Chapter 1, A Very Strange Phenomenon. The information in this book is either nonsense or it is the most centrally important thing that you could possibly learn. It is allegedly the answer to the strange riddle of the UFOs. The information contained herein is not speculation or theory, but a condensation and edited arrangement of received communications from the UFOs. The obvious weakness of this contactee information is that evidential proof of its validity is not obtainable. Its strength lies in its sheer bulk and in the similarity of messages produced by sources widely scattered around the world. The last 25 years have produced millions of words of these communications allegedly originating within the UFOs. Approximately 15 million people in the US have reported seeing UFOs, more than 2,000 contact cases have been reported, and about 700 landings have left trace evidence. 1. There is no longer any real doubt that UFOs exist. The question is, who are they? And why are they here? It is quite possible that understanding them is the most important endeavor, which we can undertake. There are thousands of people around the world who are quite certain that they know at least some of the answers to the riddles of these elusive manifestations. How did these people acquire the needed information? Their answer, one which many find hard to believe, is that they have been in contact with the occupants of the UFOs. There has been a widespread and growing pattern of people who claim contact with UFOs since the early 50s. At this point, the claims are so widespread that they constitute a pseudo-secret subculture, a sort of underground group, all over Earth. I say pseudo-secret because even though many of these contactees tell their stories, the information is of a type that our culture does not easily accept. The insiders in this underground all seem to be getting approximately the same information, and they can be found in many places both in the United States and all over the world. They are not all wide-eyed cultists, three steps in front of the men in white coats, nor are they little old ladies fresh from the medium's parlor. Primarily, contactees are normal people of average intelligence and background. Each year produces more of them. Few of these people receive or desire publicity. I've been studying paranormal phenomenon for 25 years, and for the past 14 years I've specialized in unraveling the contactee riddle. You will find in reading through this book that it requires some background in paranormal studies. The first three chapters of the book are intended to function as a synopsis of this background, and the bibliography is available to those who wish to pursue this field in greater depth. A great deal of apparently unrelated material begins to substantively add to the evidence available in the UFO contactee literature, once this mountain of contactee data is condensed. I am now in a position to make such a condensation, and this analysis of the contactee story turns into an explanation of the nature, purpose, origin, and ultimate objective of at least one large group of UFOs. The entire situation regarding the contactees reminds me of something which the late Dr. James E. McDonald said to Congress in 1968. He was reporting to the House Committee on Aeronautics and Astronautics on his conclusions regarding UFOs. He described a situation in northern France years ago, where many peasants reported stones falling from the sky. Since the reporters were dumb and unscientific, they were ignored at first. Finally, a scientist took the reports seriously and investigated the thing fully. Thus was born the science of meteoritics. Dr. McDonald suggested to Congress that in dealing with UFO reports, we now face a very similar situation in science. We have tended to ignore it because it didn't make any sense. It definitely defies any explanation. And hence the situation has evolved where we can't get going because we aren't already going. Consider the case of Travis Walton of Snowflake, Arizona, taken aboard a UFO on November 5, 1975, in plain sight of six witnesses. The witnesses were given lie detector tests. All tests showed the witnesses were telling the truth. Travis himself showed up 5 days later. He was 12 miles from the place he had been taken on board. He had a story to tell that involved his waking up inside the ship and finding several very odd-looking creatures examining him, as well as four perfectly normal-looking human types. Now, these details are pretty solid. Dr. James Harder, director of research for the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, personally investigated the case and stated that he felt there was no hoax involved. The lie detector tests given to the witnesses support the data. All indications are that this contact is authentic. In spite of this, the news coverage was so conditioned by the old ridicule lid of the 1950s that few Americans found out about it until months after the occurrence. Various UFO research groups such as APRO and MUFON, for complete listings, see bibliography, put out many reports, such as that of the Travis Walton case, which the national press passes by. And so the underground becomes more and more certain that UFOs are real and are communicating with us, while the cultural community as a whole continues to not know much of the important data. This gap in knowledge was at one time at least in great part attributable to the U.S. government's handling of investigations into the phenomena. In the late 1940s and early 50s, when the sightings and stories were gaining momentum, the Air Force, like almost everyone else, was mystified. In addition, they were responsible for the safety of American skies. They were embarrassed and concerned about these unidentified flying objects. These were the days of backyard bomb shelters. The national feeling was that Russia might well launch a nuclear attack. So it is quite understandable that the Air Force was extremely upset about their inability to explain the phenomena. The result was that the UFO phenomena was brushed off, officially, as being a ridiculous fantasy. In this atmosphere, the reliable witness was liable to refrain from reporting his UFO experience, because it might damage his reputation. Dr. J. Alan Hung X spoke about this problem in 1953. Nothing constructive is accomplished for science in the long run by mere ridicule and the implication that sightings are the products of bird brains and intellectual flyweights. Ridicule is not part of the scientific method and people should not be taught that it is. 3. After Project Blue Book came into its own, the Air Force became gradually more confident that the UFOs were not a threat to American security, but by this time the habit of ridicule of UFO sightings and sighters was well set. Gradually, the official nature of the ridicule lid has vanished, although still today there is a military injunction against servicemen reporting UFOs before they have been debriefed. But the habit of ridicule is still in effect, and has continued to successfully stop the free flow of information on the subject that is so necessary for the average citizen to have before he can really decide for himself about UFOs. As Jacobs notes in his book on the history of the UFO controversy, Hung X first polled 44 astronomers for their interest in the UFO phenomena, and found that only 17% of them were interested. He wrote them, then, about several particularly unusual and provocative sightings, and re-polled for interest. Nearly all of the astronomers had become interested in UFOs. As Hung X said, their general lethargy is due to lack of information. 4. In countries where UFO sighting information has been as freely distributed as any other news, there is a much more energetic feeling among the general populace about the significance of UFOs. There is a basic problem encountered by those trying to use the scientific method to investigate UFOs. When one begins to investigate a new phenomenon, he needs to start from some aspect of the phenomenon which is linked to present theory. The UFO phenomena does not easily compute on the calculators of our present system of physical measurements and predictive judgment. I think that it is this reason more than any other which discourages most scientists and keeps even interested men from undertaking active investigation. Ufology is a frustrating discipline to a scientist. Since it is already unfashionable to be a UFO investigator, this frustration completes the decision. And only the most daring of the scientific community will link their names with UFO studies. This set of circumstances is also true of the whole field of paranormal research, of course, of which UFOs is properly a part. It has been my personal experience that many of the researchers in ufology will, while appearing most conservative for the record, confide in sympathetic company their more esoteric theories. Some of the more experienced of these people are truly daring the outer limits of knowledge in general. I think it's high time that these outer limits be made more generally known. I've been at this pursuit of UFO understanding for over 25 years now. I've tried to maintain a totally open-minded approach to the study, considering no piece of evidence too small or too ridiculous to consider. The theory which has gradually emerged from this approach may seem a bit wild or absurd, but it is dealing with a wild and absurd bunch of data. The one thing that recommends the theory is that almost all reports which come in day by day seem to fit into it very well. One thing to remember, almost everything which we now accept as normal in our present technology would have been considered a wild and absurd impossibility a scant 100 years ago. We do not know how many millennia ahead of our present understanding the UFOs might be. I have chosen not to abide within the approved scientific method of verification of accepted data within the boundaries of currently accepted scientific opinion because this method has proven a tool ineffectual in dealing with this phenomena. I make the assumption that the reason for this lack is that the system is set up to investigate the present level of reality within our technological and scientific nexus of thought. I make the further assumption that the nexus of thinking or technology which underlies the UFO manifestations may not have any close connection to our present Earthman's philosophy of reality. History is replete with examples of the events in which reality itself proved unconformable with the current scientific or philosophical thinking. I think it is happening again. We thought that the Earth was flat at one time. Less than 400 years ago, Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake for suggesting that the Earth revolved around the Sun. Now, again, there really does seem to be a growing amount of evidence pointing to the existence of a totally different type of reality than is generally appreciated by our philosophy. If you ask anyone you meet on the street whether he believes UFOs are real, over half will answer, yes, they probably are. Most people have a lively interest in the subject and when a case is covered in their newspaper, read it and ponder it. But because most UFO cases are not covered in newspapers, the general public does not receive a great percentage of the very prevalent UFO contact information. The lack of coverage is not the only reason that many UFO cases go unreported. There are other reasons. 1. The person who is contacted by the UFO is afraid to tell about his experience, because he fears ridicule. 2. The contactee has no knowledge of UFO investigating organizations, and receives only incredulity from the people to whom he does tell his story. He would like to share his experience but does not feel he will be believed. 3. The contactee may not remember his contact experience consciously, because of a memory block affected by the UFO noughts. UFO researchers have found these three causes for silent contactees to prevail again and again. And it is theorized that a large percentage of contact cases are never discovered by investigators. The pioneer ufologist, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, has estimated that around the world there are about 100 UFO sightings every day, though most of these remain unreported. But there are still an incredible number of cases that we do know about. There is at present such a tremendous number of well-documented cases of contact with UFO occupants that Dr. Hynek has stated that it's high time we stopped looking for eggs, and started making the omelette. The problem is, of course, that these eggs are so weird that we're afraid to crack them open to make the omelette. This book is intended as an attempt to make this omelette, even if its taste is offensively pungent to some theorists' palates. But before I begin, I would like to look at just a few eggs with you. I want you to get an idea of just how strange these eggs really are. So I've taken a sample of some 15 cases, all of them UFO sightings which include a close contact with the UFO occupants. These few cases are taken from the many which are reported by the investigating organizations such as APRO, MUFON, and Flying Saucer Review. Look in the bibliography at the back of the book for a list of these information sources complete with addresses. I will not bore you with the well-known cases of the 1950s. This is a small sampling of more recent cases, in order to establish how common these UFO contact reports are, and to give you the flavor of the concoction these eggs are going to make. Case number 1, date, 1963. Place, Fern Creek, Key. Investigators, Colonel Verniani, Key. Air National Guard, D.T. Elkins, Independent Investigator. Four young boys, aged 5 to 12, observed a disc-shaped craft as it landed behind a small woods near where they were playing. A humanoid clad in a space suit, about 4 feet tall, emerged from the woods. Two of the boys threw dirt clods at the entity to provoke it into some action. The entity then shot them with a small black rod, producing a tingling sensation and slight pain. When the boys were individually questioned, all four stories matched. The description of the humanoid which they gave matched information in NICAP files of more than 200 other sightings in the Ohio River Valley area in considerable and exact detail. The boy's mother stated that she got a message in her head, telepathic, to call the University of Louisville shortly after she called the National Guard to report the sighting. Small footprints and clear landing marks were found. A day later, two unidentified men visited the landing site and eradicated the landing evidence. Although they stated that they were from the University of Louisville, this was checked out and found to be untrue. Case number 2. Date, 1965, and continuing, to the present. Place, Spain. Investigators, Antonio Ribera and Rafael Farioles, both ufologists in Spain. A planet called Amo began contacting various people in Spain in 1965. The people were well respected and educated, a writer, an engineer, a lawyer, etc. The contacts would be by telephone, and the contactee was invited to ask questions of the Amites. Later, a report answering the question would come in the mail. These reports were signed with a thumbprint bearing a distinctive mark much like the alchemical symbol for Uranus, an H with a shorter vertical line through the bar. The contactees were told that the UMO craft would be at a certain place on a certain date. The craft showed up on schedule and pictures were taken of it. On the bottom of the craft there is the cross-barred H symbol. The reports have continued to come in through the intervening years, and speak on many technical subjects, such as physics and biology. The UMO words which are used in these reports, when collected together and considered, form a self-consistent language structure. They say that they are from a planet which revolves around a star which they have tentatively identified as being our Wolf 424, and that they were first attracted to our solar system by a radio signal which was sent from Earth in 1934. They gave the frequency of the signal, 413.44 megacycles. Between the ages of 14 and 16 the vocal cords of the children become sclerosed and for this reason most of the adult inhabitants of UMO are unable to talk and must use telepathy. These UMO reports are an exceptionally interesting instance of UFO contact, and they continue at the present time. Flying Saucer Review occasionally updates this continuing story. Case number 3. Date, May the 4th to the 9th, 1969. Place, Bibadero, Brazil. Investigator, Helvio Bielaxo of Sicani, a research group of Belo Horizonte, Brazil. José Antonio da Silva, a 24-year-old soldier of excellent personal character and reputation, was abducted by small, red-bearded humanoids who forcibly took him aboard their craft. During his confinement aboard their strange vessel, a fair, tall, human-looking being appeared to him, though the smaller aliens did not seem to be able to see him. This being warned da Silva of a danger which involved the whole of mankind which might be avoided if man on Earth changed his ways. Da Silva was told that intervention by unknown beings, and possible calamities, might be involved. 12 days after his abduction, da Silva was awakened by a sudden urge to go outside. He did so and saw three of the red-bearded aliens, who had apparently summoned him telepathically. He quickly re-entered his house and locked the door against them, for he felt that part of the danger to come might involve them. Case number 4. Date, summer, 1973 places, all over Pennsylvania. Investigator, Stan Gordon, MUFON State Director. Because this is a report of 118 separate contacts with unknown creatures, the date and place have to be generalized. These reports vary somewhat but have the primary details more or less in common. The salient feature of these cases is the creature or creatures who are sighted. They are hairy, ape-like beings with glowing eyes and apparent ears, large noses, fang-like teeth, and the long arms of an ape. Where Gordon was able to take footprint casts, the print was a large and three-toed track. The sightings were, in the majority, in wooded areas or near rural or small town homes. During the sighting, animals would be still, but before and after a sighting, both animals and small children acted as though they were quite disturbed, cows huddling, dogs barking, children crying all night. These creatures have been sighted often in connection with UFO sightings, have been seen entering and leaving UFOs, and on occasion a telepathic communication from a source connected with the creatures has been reported. In three of these encounters, a creature has been shot. One was shot with a .30-06, see case number 6. Another was shot with a 16-gal, shotgun at close range, and the third with a .38 pistol. The latter two creatures both disappeared in a flash of light, like a photo flash bulb going off, on being shot. Case number 5. Date, the 10th of November 1973. Place, Pascagoula, Mississippi. Investigators, Dr. J. Alan Hanek, Chairman of the Department of Astronomy, Northwestern University, Director, Center for UFO Studies, Dr. James E. Harder, Professor of Civil Engineering, University of California, Director of Research, APRO. Charles Hickson, age 45, an 18-year-old Galvin Parker were fishing when an oblong, blue-gray craft 35 to 40 feet long descended and hovered near them. The craft made a zipping noise. A door appeared in the craft and three humanoids or robots came out and approached the two men. Like their craft, these entities did not touch the ground but moved just above it, proceeding without moving their legs. The entities were short and had elephant hide skin, slits for eyes, and pincer-like hands. When Parker saw the entities approach, he passed out. Hickson was paralyzed, but was able to continue observing what happened. Two of the entities picked up Hickson by his arms and carried him inside the ship. When he was picked up, Hickson lost all feeling, including that of weight. He was taken to a bare, brightly lit room. He could not see where the light came from. The entities placed him in a reclining position, still floating in air, and an eye-like instrument scanned back and forth across his body with thoroughness, as if it were examining or photographing him. This episode lasted somewhere between 15 and 40 minutes. Hickson is not at all sure about the time. After the examination was over, the entities left Hickson alone for a while, and then floated him back to where they had picked him up on the river bank. About an hour later, the two shaken fishermen went to the sheriff's office to report their story. They were interrogated exhaustively and afterwards were left alone, in a bugged room. The recording of their conversation at the time reveals that both men were quite frightened by their experience, the emotional trauma having been so great to Parker that, after Hickson left the room, he began to pray. Ultimately, he suffered nervous breakdown as a result of this experience. Hickson, though plagued with nightmares, and continuing feelings of terror about the experience, came through it better, and was able to work with investigators who wished to ascertain the truth about his experience. A 2.5-hour lie detector test, given by a highly skeptical polygraph operator, revealed that Hickson was telling the truth. When Dr. Harder used the technique of time regression hypnosis on Hickson, he too felt that Hickson was telling the truth about the experience, for he said a strong feeling of terror is practically impossible to fake under hypnosis. Case number 6. Date, the 25th of October 1973. Place, Greensburg, Pennsylvania. Investigator, Berthold Erich Schwartz, M.D., Consultant, Brainwave Laboratory, Essex Company Hospital Center, Cedar Grove, New Jersey, consultant to Flying Saucer Review. This case is perhaps the most interesting and many-faceted of the 188 Pennsylvania creature sightings included in case number 4. It began at 9 o'clock at night, when a young farmer, called Stephen Pulaski in the report given in Flying Saucer Review, and at least 15 other witnesses saw a bright red ball hovering over a field near them. Stephen grabbed a 30.06 rifle, and he and two 10-year-old neighbor boys went to investigate it. Stephen's auto headlights dimmed as he neared the object, and as the object descended towards the field, Stephen's German Shepherd, back at the house, became very disturbed. The object was now bright white, and appeared to be about 100 feet in diameter. It was buzzing much like a lawnmower would. They stood watching the object on the ground, and then the neighbor boys saw something walking along by the fence. Stephen thought it looked like two bears, and he fired a tracer bullet over the bears' heads. The creatures were very tall, one 7 feet, the other over 8 feet tall. These measurements were easier than usual to get because the entities were silhouetted against the fence and so could be accurately judged. They were hairy and long-armed, with greenish-yellow eyes. They made a noise like a baby whining. A smell like burning rubber was present. Stephen, realizing that these creatures were not bears and that they were coming nearer to him, fired over the entities' heads once more and, when they kept on coming, fired directly at the larger creature. When the creature was hit, the glowing 150 feet diameter object disappeared from the field, instantaneously, and the motor noise stopped. The two creatures turned around and walked back towards the woods. In the field where the object had been was a glowing area about 150 feet in diameter, which was gone by the next morning. While it was still there, a state trooper who came to investigate the story went up to within 200 yards of it, then stopped, went back to call in the UFO researcher Stan Gordon. The trooper felt that Stephen was so disturbed that it was better that he be watched, and Stephen wouldn't go near the glowing area. It was 2 a.m. when Stan Gordon's study group team and Stephen and his father went back to the landing site. The animals were acting scared, and Stephen's dog was tracking something which no one could see at the edge of the woods. Suddenly Stephen began rubbing his head and face and looking as though he were about to faint. Several people approached him, but he threw them off, growling like an animal and flailing his arms. His own dog ran towards him and Stephen attacked the dog. Two of the investigators also experienced some feelings of lightheartedness and difficulty in breathing at this point. Stephen continued running around, growling and swinging his arms, and then collapsed in a manured area, face down. He lay there for a time, then began to come to himself, and said, "Get away from me. It's here. Get back." Sulfur-like odor was noticed. Stephen and the group got away from the area, but Stephen kept mumbling that he would protect the group. He said he saw a man in a black hat and cloak, who told Stephen, "If man doesn't straighten up, the end is near." The man also told Stephen, "There is a man here now, who can save the world." Needless to say, the investigators present felt quite concerned about Stephen's health, and it was here that Dr. Schwartz was called in. Dr. Schwartz's subsequent psychiatric study of Stephen yielded results that he feels point clearly to the incident having occurred just as reported. For indeed it would be terrifying for a man such as Stephen, used to a very practical and realistic type of life, to shoot and hit an 8-foot antagonist which then was not harmed in any way. The numerous other witnesses to the various phases of the incident also bear out its having happened. Who is the man in black, and what do the predictions about mankind really mean? That is a matter for interpretation. But that Stephen had the experience has been thoroughly documented. Case number 7. Date: the 28th of October 1973. Place: Bahia Blanca, Argentina. Investigator: Liria Di Giorgi, APRO investigator. Very early in the morning, truck driver Dionisio Lanco had a flat tire and pulled off the road in an isolated area. As he set up the jack to change the tire, he saw lights in the distance, but thought little of them until, as they approached, they suddenly changed to a brilliant blue. When Lanka tried to get up and look for the source of this odd light, he found he was apparently paralyzed and could not move.